Hey everybody, this is Bobby Porter from Battle for the Planet of the Apes, Elm Street 5, The Blob, amongst other things, and you are listening to Moose's Monster Mash.
You're listening to Moose's Monster.
Welcome, Horror Hounds, to another all-new episode of Moose's Monster Mash. I'm your host, Moose, and it's a new episode, but we're bringing back an old friend. And it's great, because every time he comes on, he's got something new. And I couldn't be more excited to talk about this. So let's not bury it much longer. Let's bring on friend of the show, Dacre Stoker, to talk about the upcoming documentary, Father of Dracula. Dacre.
Paul, great to be here. Thank you so much for having me. This is a big day as our documentary and Bram Stoker, that's Father Dracula with Jason Figgis as director, John West as writer, and lots of input that I've given them to actually drops today. So by the time you see our podcast, it'll be live and hopefully people are funding it. But the bottom line is anytime creatives get together and decide we're going to do something, you got a couple routes to go. One, you put together a proposal and you shoot this thing out to studios. You try to get people to take the bait and talk to you and raise the funding and all this. And the three of us just decided, you know what, we're going to do this thing. And we need a little bit of funding, like 25 grand to rent space to do all the editing. We've already got a lot of the filming done, Paul, and that's because on all of my trips to Transylvania, Scotland, Ireland, to Whitby, England, a friend of mine, Colin Hamilton, came along. He shot footage. So a lot of it's out of our own pockets. But the key is for Jason Figgis to put this together, edit this together. For that, you need to rent studio time and really good equipment to make it just right. So yeah, that's why I'm here. And if you guys, I'll say this a couple of times, like a used car salesman, if you like what you're hearing today in our show and our questions back and forth of what comes out of it, please go to Indiegogo and consider a donation to Father of Dracula.
So whether you like what you hear or not, go support it anyway. I mean, everything this guy and his creative team brings to the table knocks it out of the park. So, I mean, I haven't been let down yet from the books, the comics, just everything that the Stokerverse is building out. Now the potential for this documentary from, the mouth of the family. I can unequivocally say I am super excited for this documentary.
Well, I am too. I have lived through the last, sort of 12 years or so, doing my research, reading all the other biographies that are out there, watching the different documentaries, A&E has done and things about Dracula. And they always get little things wrong. They get sensational crap, inserted just to try to sell the book or sell the thing. And it sort of drives me crazy. And it's like, I feel it's my job to get the story right. And believe me, the story is not dull and boring. It doesn't need sensationalism to be sort of plugged in to make the thing sell. It's Bram's life is really very compelling, very interesting. And the fact that there were so many portions and events in his life, weird things that happened that ended up going into his psyche and coming out his pen. And then getting on the typewriter and making its way into the pages of Dracula. And that's what the three of us are going to do for folks, is kind of show these things, how these things came about, and then how they worked their way into the fabric of this novel that is, since 1897 has, changed the world and changed the way people think about, vampires and horror and Gothic literature.
Well, and, speaking for me personally, I love when families involved and, you know this, I mean, like the time we spent with like Lynn Lugosi and all this, because they have more intimate knowledge than you can find just picking up a book and reading. And because there's oftentimes the passed down information or just little tidbits that you find in just like, so, interestingly, you know, sometimes in the family Bible,
yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
That's not always accessible to the general public. So when I hear the family is involved in a biography of somebody like Brahm, it's like, yes. You know, and I mean, you know, we've talked about it, you know, time and time again with your tours. I mean, you've been keeping this alive for a while.
I have, but I got to not divert because you brought it up and this is cool. I wasn't thinking of talking about that today, but since you brought it up, I'm going to take you up on it. So Brahm was one of seven kids. He was the third in line. He had an older brother, Thornley. Then he had a sister, Matilda, then Brahm, and then Tom down the line. So of those seven people, only three had offspring. Brahm had a son, Tom had a daughter, and then George, the youngest brother, had a son and a daughter. George is my great-grandfather. So all those seven, only three have offspring, and two have offspring alive today. Tom had the daughter. The daughter married and had a son, Daniel Farson. Now, Daniel Farson was a family member, but he had an axe to grind, which I uncovered just not too many years ago. He wrote a biography of Brahm, and probably about 50% was accurate. And that's why I wanted to just pick up on, just because it's family doesn't mean it's accurate. What I found out is, as you well know, and all your listeners probably do too, you know, family blood is thicker than water, but sometimes that blood can be pretty toxic because you're tight, you're close, and you know secrets, and sometimes there's weird feelings. Well, the fact that Daniel Farson's mother had a sort of a resentment thing about all of the publicity that Florence Stoker got, that's Brahm's wife, and then obviously when Brahm died, that's his widow. She lived for many years after Brahm died, and she did quite well financially with the sale of the dramatic rights and then the film rights. And for whatever reason, the Farson family, being, you know, very close on the family tree, had some resentment about that. And so the son, when he went on to become a TV personality and an author, some of the things in the biography I learned that Brahm's great-grandsons told me were absolutely wrong, and they were just written out of spite. And I'll tell you what they are. Number one, Farson said that Brahm had a loveless marriage. They only had one child, and so therefore his sexuality was in question. Either he didn't like to have sex with his wife or his wife didn't like to have sex with him. So sort of creating a, let's say, an urban rumor, urban legend type thing that isn't correct, but it is born of some circumstantial evidence that worked for Farson to sell his books. He had no problem putting it in there. He also interpreted Brahm Stoker's death certificate. So I won't go into all the details, but Brahm physically had a rough life. The first 7 years of his life, he was, you know, sickly, he was infirmed, he was, you know, an invalid. He recovered, he became a champion athlete. In the family, there was Bright's disease. His mother had it. She ended up going blind in an eye. So did Tom Stoker. There was also asthma in the family. So a lot of genetic things.
I want to pause you for a second. Yeah. How messed up is it to call something that causes you to go blind Bright's disease?
No, there was two different things.
Oh, okay. Damn. Yeah,
I'm sorry. No. There was Bright's disease, which is the liver and kidneys.
Okay.
But blindness was something else. Part of it, Paul, and I've started looking into this. Sadly, the medicines people took back in the day, arsenic for coughs, for things like this, lead. You take little bits of lead, you know. And it was like, oh, they thought that, you know, mercury, oh, this is good for them to get rid of this, and it would cause you to go blind. So, yeah, but I'm glad you cleared that up. So I'll cut this short. Bottom line is, as a family member, I do have privy information, but I also have a moral compass. And Bram's got two great grandsons still alive, my cousins. And by golly, I'm not going to, you know, kind of sell them out just to try to come up with sensational stuff and switch some of the like alternate facts. So I really, you know, respect that they're still alive and the story needs to be told rather than capitalizing on some kind of squabbles within a family to make up crap.
Well, and it's, you know, this could just be my opinion, but I'm sure you would agree. I'd be proud to be, you know, a grandson or a relative of Bram Stoker. And so the more of, you know, the more there are, the more that legacy gets to carry on, you know? So yeah, just that one little, oh, he had one child, that cuts that legacy super short.
Yeah. And I'll tell you a little more about that one child, which is interesting. So he got married to a lady named Anne, Neely, excuse me. They had a daughter named Anne. During World War II, Anne got married. That husband died. He was an aviator flying for the British Air Force. And then she had two sons with that fellow. And then she married again closer to the end of the war. He was also an aviator, but he was a recon guy taking pictures. He got shot down and died. And they had a son. So three boys, two different husbands, both died during World War II. And as a result, those young boys only had a mother to raise them. And so they moved in with their grandfather, Noel Stoker, Bram's son. So living today, Paul, are two, you know, early 80s great-grandsons of Bram who have some really cool stories told to them personally by their grandfather, Bram's son. And you know, that to me is gold. It's also responsibility for me to uphold and to say, you know, which of those stories are you willing for me to share to the world? You know, can you tell me a little bit about what Bram was like, especially during those Lyceum years, which dominated obviously most of his years? Because one of the things Farson said was, well, he was never around. He was always at the theater. So how could he have a good marriage? And the wife, she was off, you know, doing nothing. She was left at home as a stay-at-home mom just to raise the kid. Well, nothing could be farther from the truth. Bram used to come home early in the morning, like 2 o'clock in the morning after the plays and dinner, late dinners after the play, sleep in a bit, spend most of the day at home, and then at about 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock, go back to the theater to get things ready for the next night's performances. But he was warm and cuddly with his son. They used to, you know, Bram used to sort of roll over, lie on his back and have Noel sit on his chest and they'd tell stories. And he used to collect train stubs. And everywhere Bram used to go, he used to collect the little train stubs, ticket stubs, and he'd give them to Noel. And Noel would collect them and fantasize about, oh, I can take this train to this place. So he went off on his own sort of travels based on the ticket stubs that his dad brought him. Bram would collect coins from all his travels around England, around Europe, to America with the Lyceum Theater. He'd bring them back, give his son these coins. His son would learn who the personalities were on the heads of the coins. He'd learn his history through the coins. And Bram used to, you know, try to put together complete sets of these coins. And when Noel could recite the historical periods and lineage of all the rulers or whoever's on the coins, he got to keep them. So those are some of the stories, the warm fuzzies that are based on reality passed down through people in the family. And it's that type of thing that I'm going to be putting into this documentary. Who really was Bram Stoker? You know, trying to dispel some of the crap that has been put into books just to sell.
Sounds like he's a family guy who worked nights.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's literally the same schedule I keep.
Well, there you go. He also really felt it was important to have his son well-educated. So he joined through his, I mean, Bram was in a wonderful place in society, being the head of the Lyceum Theater, manager of Irving. He got to rub elbows with all the rich and the famous who wanted to come to the theater to watch Henry Irving play. So he was invited to join the Skinners Guild. Now, back in those days, there still was skinning going on, you know, of animal pelts to make fur hats, fur coats, and so on. That guild would take care of their own. And Bram joined it and paid his dues to make sure, if he was not able, that they would take care of the education of his son. And they helped pay for his education at a very good private school, Winchester College. So young Noel got a first-class education, and he grew up to be a very successful chartered accountant. And one of the things that he did that made him some good money was brought, you can believe it, the Singer Sewing Machine Company public. Yeah, I mean, he didn't own it, but he was the accountant. So it's little things like that that, you know, have nothing to do with Dracula, but it goes to show who this man was, how he was wired, what sort of compassionate person he was. And he, you know, he had a very loving family, good relationship. When they went on holidays to Whitby, to Cruden Bay, Bram and Florence had Noel along, and they had all kinds of fun.
That's insane. And yeah, I guess that does lead me to what's next is, what do you decide to cut from his life for this documentary? Because I mean, this is obviously now the third time you've been on, and we've covered Bram and his legacy and, you know, Dracula's legacy numerous times, but there's a lot to unpack there. So without making it like a 5 to 6 hour documentary, how do you make it a solid documentary and without leaving out the good stuff?
Well, thank goodness, Jason Figgis, the Dublin-based documentary filmmaker, and John West had done this before with other people. One of them that really caught my attention was a guy called Sir Simon Marsden, who was a photographer knighted, like Irving was, Gothic photographer. And so these guys know how to take all of my massive volume of stuff and say, what's the point here? I mean, you're right, Paul. We can't do the life and times of Bram Stoker and Noel Stoker and Florence Stoker from start to finish. But what we try to do is what things in his life, first of all, you know, a synopsis of his life, and what are those things that would work their way into the fabric of Dracula? What would influence him to think of certain things, to go to a library and open a certain book and to be his attention caught by a certain thing in a book that would then work its way into Dracula? So luckily, I don't have to edit that down on film. I like I'm talking to you guys, I'll like spew it all out and let the really seasoned filmmakers figure it out. But, you know, maybe some of the stuff I just mentioned could be summed up in one or two sentences. You know, like Bram Stoker really was a family man. He had a loving son, and, you know, and his wife was really there. I know that the wife would go to the theater with George Stoker, my great-grandfather, on the nights, obviously, when Bram was working, because I've actually seen in my research, the Beefsteak Room is a dining club in the back of the Lyceum Theater. And they had little cards that Bram would fill out to decide who was going to sit at the table with Henry Irving. That was like the A seat. Those cards have been kept, because Bram was a pack rat, in a box, and they're now in the Shakespeare Library in outside of London. And I've had access to those, and I know who's been at the table at what dates. That's how I found, I think we've talked about it, Arminius Vanbury, who appears in Dracula, seated at the table in April of 1890, when Bram was starting to write Dracula. So it's little things like that that would be pulled out a little kernel. And it's like, well, he used real people from real life and real events. And sometimes he used them as character names. Sometimes he really did get information about, for instance, Vlad Dracula from Arminius Vanbury. And that's why it says in the novel, my friend Arminius tells me who this, you know, Vlad Dracula was. Must have been that Vivoid who fought the Turks, blah, blah, blah. So that's kind of long-winded, but luckily I've got seasoned documentary filmmakers that I am confident will do a great job with all of my information in about a 90-minute documentary.
Now, all that said, I think a multi-series film or even a mini-series where you can expand on it more, the life and times of Brahm and his family, would be really interesting.
Yeah, that is part of the bucket list. Doing this low budget with John and Jason and doing it well and giving a real, you know, sort of Irish feel to it presents itself as a great opportunity. The long-term project would be just as you described. A segment in Ireland, a segment in England, a segment in Scotland, you know, Whitby, Cruden Bay, Transylvania, the libraries, all these different things. And then the legacy, as you and I have chatted about, the stage, the film, you know, all of that could be expanded, you know, into a 5, 6, 7 part miniseries. But for now, to me, it's, you know, condensing all the really good stuff and having it together in one place to go to film festivals, hopefully to be picked up by a, you know, some sort of a History Channel, something like that, would be great and very satisfying. And I think the viewers would love it. And then if they love it and are clamoring for more, that's when we come back to the drawing board and say, okay, you want more? We'll give you more. It's funny, it's sort of mutual, but years ago I was in south of Dublin in a film festival called Dunlowry was the town film festival I was presenting. And as Jason Figgis was actually putting some of his films up, and we just chatted casually about, hey, let me come and see your film and let me come and see your presentation. And, you know, we sort of had breakfast together and had a drink together and like, one day we should work together. And we just kept touching base. And during COVID, it was kind of like, you know, everybody's got during COVID stories. You know, we said, gosh, you know, do you think we could ever get this together and do this in a big way? So we put together I amassed all this information. He thought it was great. John threw his hat in and said, yeah, let's organize this. Let's come up with a budget. And, you know, we had one company nibble on it and then dropped it. And so he said, oh, okay. You know, just kind of, we'll just toss that up to COVID and maybe something happen in the future. And nobody did pick it up. So that's when we said, okay, forget the massive project. Let's just do a real lean project with all the best of the best. So it really was just sort of the two of us. And then he mentioned, oh, I worked with this guy, John West came on. So there was really no approaching. It just sort of happened, as they say, sort of organically from our mutual interest. And luckily, me being in Dublin, every year I'd go over for the Dublin Festival, Bram Stoker Festival. Jason would come along. We'd share more thoughts, have another beer together. You know how it goes. And then you kind of talk and just say, hey, one day we'll do this. So, yeah, that's how it came around.
So the campaign is live as we speak. How long does the campaign run?
It's 2 months. So, no, actually 3 months. I think it's 3 months. I'm sorry, 60 days. And yeah, we got to raise about $25,000. And there's, you know, I can't remember off the top of my head all the little rewards, but those are out there. Sort of the typical rewards, you know, signed scripts and all that kind of good stuff.
And obviously, I don't want to go too much into what's in the documentary, but do you go into his time with Bill Cody at all?
Ah, I'm glad you brought that up because you and I have had some giggles about that. And you know something that I have not said to you about Bill Cody? I live in Aiken, South Carolina now. And there happens to be a guy, and I won't use his name on the air, but he's a friend. I've known him for years. I did not know, and he didn't know, of the connection between my great-granduncle and Buffalo Bill Cody, who happens to be his great-grandfather. Can you believe it?
That's insane.
We've been we've been riding mountain bikes together. He's a photographer. He's a musician. And it's like, oh my gosh, what an interesting connection. So not because of that, but yes, we do have some of those, what I call interesting gold nuggets that Bram Stoker put in the novel because of relationships, because of this particular relationship. He met Buffalo Bill Cody on one of his 8 trips to America with Sir Henry Irving, traveled all over the country by train, and the 100 people with the Lyceum Theater Troupe, you know, guys who were costume designers, makeup, set designer, all this stuff. And Bram, over time, was quite enamored with Buffalo Bill Cody and loved America, loved the idea of this is the new frontier. This is the place where there is literary freedom. This is without all the constraints that Bram faced as a young Protestant guy in a predominantly Catholic Ireland and Catholic Trinity College. So he used the persona of Buffalo Bill, the sort of wild frontiers guy, as the basis for good parts of Quincy Morris, obviously the gun-toting American from the Wild West who, you know, very sort of brash, his accent, you know, caught Lucy and she thought that was really interesting. But he also used Buffalo Bill for the basis for a character in really my second favorite Bram Stoker short story, which is The Virgin's Embrace, which is was called The Squaw when Bram wrote it, but we changed that name because of political correctness. But Elias Hutcheson is this brash American who shows up in Nuremberg and kind of busts the party of Bram and Florence. They don't have those names in the story, but it is them. And they end up having a very interesting day in and around the beautiful city of Nuremberg. But it ends tragically for somebody in the torture chamber in Nuremberg. So that's one. And then the other one, the other character he used, very unfortunately named, I don't think Bram really realized that the name Grizzly Dick would quite have the connotations back in those days that it does today. But he was the grizzly frontiersman in the book Shoulder of Shasta. And this guy comes out of the woods and marries this British lady who has to leave that musty, mildewy England to go to dry California. Now, Paul, let me just mention this for a moment. I am convinced that Bram Stoker was affected by respiratory allergies and asthma in the same way that young lady was. He moved from musty, mildewy Clontarf inland at the age of 7, and that's when he recovered from his own asthma and started building up his respiratory his strength and his resistance. I think that was semi-autobiographical because he himself came to California on at least 4 of those trips with the Lyceum Theater and would have found the very dry atmosphere, desert-like atmosphere, especially around the area of Northern California where the Mount Shasta is. So I think, again, that's another little gold nugget, not just Grizzly Dick, but the situation with the, you know, the asthma and trying to come to a drier climate.
I say it. He learned, he'd like, oh, I can breathe. This is a new feeling. Like speaking as an asthmatic, yeah, when you get to those drier climates, you're like, whoa, this is awesome.
Yeah, I can't imagine. My wife is asthmatic, and my son is, but he's grown out of it, thank goodness. But I observed some of these asthma attacks. I've been a PE teacher for 20 years. I've seen kids in sport have asthma brought on by either allergies or stress. And it's just like, you know, running 400 yards and somebody sticking their hand over your mouth and say, oh, go ahead and breathe.
Yeah.
It is horrifying to watch. And unless you have that inhaler nearby, dude, those poor people are in a whole world of hurt. And I can only imagine Bram going through that as a child and possibly feeling he's going to suffocate to death. I mean, my God, Paul, you know it. But, you know, this thing, waterboarding, is the same bloody thing. It's not an asthmatic reaction, but it's a drowning, suffocating feeling when people pour water over a towel over your face and you just can't breathe.
So, you know, it's interesting. You know, we're talking about Bram, this legendary author. And just going through the notes, he was mentored by the Wilds.
Yeah.
Also legendary writers. Like, how... before we get into that, I'm trying to picture going back and telling a young Bram Stoker, just like 7 years old, like, hey, this is what your life is going to look like. Brace yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Get ready. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, it's mind blowing.
Well, what you're going to find out, and there's a lot of mind blowing stuff when you really look into it. Bram was the only member of the family who wasn't a medicine man, a scientist. Three of them became doctors, my great-grandfather being one of them. And then the other son was a civil servant. And then the two daughters were artists. Bram became the only, you know, creative. He started at Trinity College and he did his master's in mathematics. He was the head of the Historical Society, Philosophical Society, big time athlete. And then he went to work as a civil servant in Dublin Castle in a very sort of boring, dull job as a clerk of the Petty Sessions Legal Department, and then became the inspector of all clerks all over Ireland. So he got to be pretty important, but it was dull as dishwater for Bram Stoker, who was a sort of a, you know, budding artist, a budding poet and a writer. And I can say all that with confidence because I discovered his lost journal. And all those things in his journal, he was just beginning to explore. His father was dead set against him going to the theater and getting involved professionally in the theater. They used to go to watch the theater together. And then Bram wrote pro bono reviews of the theater. So that was where he was kind of living out his fantasy life, his reviewing theater and so on. And he told his mom and dad that, oh, this is so wonderful. He'd just come back from Paris on a work trip for the clerks. And he had met Genevieve Ward and said, I just love the theater. I'm going to write a play for this lady one day. And the father wrote a letter to Bram, basically warning him off the theater, saying, this is not a life for you. So somehow after that letter was written, Bram kind of took advice and sought the mentorship of Oscar Wilde's mother. So Wilde had been dating the lady that Bram ended up marrying. Don't know how friendly Bram was with Oscar, but he was friendly with William Wilde, Oscar's older brother. They were classmates together in Trinity. They were in the Philosophical Society together. Bram actually proposed him. So these guys were tight, but I also know that Bram would go to what's called literary soirees. And this is where Mrs. Wilde would have all these literary people. They'd recite poetry. They'd kind of almost like Bible study. They'd talk about books together. So this was where Bram was getting the support he needed when he didn't get it from his father to flex his muscles and become a poet and a writer. And one of the really cool things that I found in Bram's own library was a book that Lady Jane Wilde wrote all about Irish folklore and mythology. And in it all was a page that I now put, I've only found it recently, put into my presentations, and it will be in this documentary. It mentioned that old Irish folklore and superstitions about fairies and goblins and banshees, very similar to the vampires of Transylvania, of which Madame Gerard has just recently written about. Madame Gerard is Emily Gerard, who wrote a whole essay on Transylvanian superstitions that was in Bram's notes. So he obviously took that advice from her book and went and picked up a copy of the 19th Century Magazine and seeked out Emily Gerard's Transylvanian superstitions, of which he used them all in the novel. So, you know, part of that influence and mentorship, as you mentioned, paid big dividends for Bram as he found sources of not only confidence, but specific things that he put into the novel from Mrs. Lady Jane Wilde.
Well, and speaking of the novel, you've recently found a new translation from, like, Iceland, Sweden?
Yeah, both places. They're kind of falling in. But here's the quick story there. 1901, Dracula's published in 1897 in England. 1899 in the U.S. and 1901 in Iceland, but not nobody knew up until 1989, I believe. Richard Dalby, a serious researcher scholar in England, found one of the copies of the books and looked at the preface for the Icelandic edition and had it translated and realized it was very different than the regular, both in length and also in content, of the preface of the Archibald Constable edition in 1897. And it made, the preface made the book sound like it was based on realism, total realism, very true, all this. But he stopped there. Fast forward to 2017, I think, Hans de Roos, a Dutch-German fellow, had the rest of the book translated. I actually helped him with some of my old sporting contacts in Denmark who knew how to speak Icelandic and had the thing translated and realized the story was dramatically real. Another guy, Richard Burkhorn, found that what was typical in those days, and de Roos pretty much found the same thing, is that if an author from a foreign country wanted to have a book published in that country, they had to have it published for free in a newspaper first. So you'd give away your book, they'd publish one chapter, you know, either once a day for 27 days, as in Dracula, or once a week, 27 weeks, whatever it was. But in this case, as you just mentioned, in Sweden and then in Iceland, the newspaper editors apparently were pretty free and liberal with adding stuff to the newspaper columns of Dracula to make the story more sensational or scary or appropriate for that readership. Then the newspaper was then collected in Iceland by the same guy that was the newspaper editor, was also a publisher, and he simply published that new version that was more Swedish or Icelandic. Bram Stoker was never aware of it. He didn't speak Icelandic or Swedish. Nobody in my family, and I've checked with the guys, all the papers they've had, there's no record of it ever, that he didn't sign any special contract with them. We have no idea how it happened. And it's one of the coolest mysteries that keeps, you know, the probably the most recent interesting mystery is, was Bram Stoker aware of it? And what's the story all about? Who was the one that actually added the extra material to it? Well, de Roos has actually found one other cool thing with it, Paul. It's also on crowdfunding right now, just like our Father of Dracula and Indiegogo. He found in the Swedish newspapers that on each column, somebody sketched a little drawing appropriate to what the column was that day. And he's collected all those drawings. And since he's an artist as well, graphically reformatted them and colored them. So now he's putting on Kickstarter the Swedish first edition illustrations, which essentially is the first graphic adaptation of Dracula. And he's put it together in a book to try to sell. And of course, he got me to write the introduction to it.
Now, could you imagine doing that in doing that same thing in America? You know, since like he used the vampire scare as part of his story, could you imagine releasing this month by month in the newspapers over here around that time? It would have caused hysteria.
Well, I tell you, they did release it here in a Charlotte newspaper and a Chicago newspaper. They had to, prior to this story being published in 1899 by, whoever did it, I forget now. So along with the New England vampire scare of exactly the same time, of which Bram was very aware of and actually took notes from a newspaper article from 1896, New York World newspaper, about the vampire scare. I'm sure there were some people that thought, what the heck is this doing in the fictional part of the newspaper? This should be front page news that we've got these vampires floating around. Luckily, they're not coming to America just yet. They're going between Transylvania, Whitby, and London and staying over there.
Talk about a circle of life. You know, it started with pulling articles from the newspaper, ends up getting published in a newspaper. It's a very interesting cycle.
It's a great observation. It is. It is a circle of life. Yeah.
So, you know, we've talked before about the Dracula legacy and all this. where do you guys fall on the Nosferatu front and that split?
Yeah, there's certainly been a lot of discussion over the years about how the copyright infringement happened, and you know, who's to blame and so on, and what are the factors. So I spent about a year and a half doing some research, and luckily I had a contact who was equally as interested as I was in Germany, a guy by the name of Holger Mandel. He's a film historian, and he wanted to find out from the German court records, what was Prana Film's perspective? What were they saying? You know, like, did you think you could get away with it? Or why did you not approach Mrs. Stoker? So Brand died in 1912, 1914. She became aware of this. No, it wasn't until, excuse me, that's when the stage play started. 1920, she became aware of it. 22, it came out. So what I found, and Holger found, to sort of cut a year and a half saga short, is all the letters between the Independent Society of Authors, the German lawyer they hired on behalf of Mrs. Stoker after she berated them to represent her for her husband's interest, who had been a member of the Independent Society of Authors. At first, they didn't want to represent her. She wasn't a member, and she was a female, and she berated them. That's typical sort of Florence. So they did represent. They hired a lawyer, and for 2.5 years, this lawyer charted up the bills and was involved in this court case. Luckily, the British Museum Library has all those letters, so we can see when the lawyer reports back to the Independent Society of Authors and they report to Mrs. Stoker what happened in the court. But you only get one side of it. Holger could never find any of the similar records in the German court system. And his explanation was, as hard as he tried, he thinks they were destroyed in bombings and fires, relocations. It's just not there. And he's tried like crazy, and others have as well. So what we understand is this. Dracula wasn't the first copyright infringement that Prana Films did. It was actually Dr. Jekyll and Hyde. So they took an unapproved adaptation of Jekyll and Hyde and turned that into a film. They then did the same thing with Dracula. They did never approach Mrs. Stoker and say, let's make a deal. The first she heard about it was when she was told, there's a film adaptation of your husband's book over here in Germany. It's about to open. So what happened was the film was already in 5 or 6 different countries as an advanced copy being looked at. So long story short, when she and the court system prevailed and found Prana Films guilty of a unauthorized adaptation, they said, you know, we got to fine you X number of dollars and withdraw the films. They said, well, we're bankrupt. They said, well, then you're going to have to destroy the film. They said, we can't destroy the films. They're already gone into all these different countries. And the Independent Society of Authors were told this. They would then figured out with the German lawyer that if they were going to pursue getting all these films back, they were going to have a similar case in the Netherlands, in Spain, in all these different countries. And they said, enough. We've spent enough on this. We got no money back because of the bankruptcy. And it was, in fact, Mrs. Stoker who didn't get anything out of it, but she did not claim or did not force anybody to destroy the copies of the films. That was the German court system. And funnily enough, I've met a lawyer in a friend of mine in my another world of court tennis who says in his law school, I think it was Northwestern, that case is still studied to this day, that a court system should not have used destroying of a art form, writing, drawing, or film, as restitution for bankruptcy. That was, you know, not appropriate, too severe. Now, as we know, they were not all destroyed. Mrs. Stoker didn't get any money, but she did set legal precedent with the victory in that court case. And thank goodness, because you and I have talked about it, it's a darn good film. And it lives to this day. It's been remastered many times. And don't we have a whole new version coming out real soon? Yeah. So it's a happy ending. And one other quick thing is there was a copy of the film floating around America at the time that Mrs. Stoker and Hamilton Dean and John Balderston were actually successful with their stage adaptation. It was a big hit in Europe and America. Universal Films was getting interested in the buying the film rights of the stage rights that Bram had protected. And they were using them here with Dean and Balderston. And Mrs. Stoker wrote a letter very concerned to the Independent Society of Authors that copy of Nosferatu floating around America would dissuade Universal from buying the rights and turning the play into a film. Because if there's a free copy flying around, why the heck do you need to buy the rights to ours? And somehow, in 1930, Universal decided to purchase that film to use for, you know, background research or whatever, or just to get it off the market so that they can go ahead in 31 with Lugosi and Todd Browning as the director creating Dracula. And we know that started the whole thing.
Yeah, no, it's... again, very interesting cycle that this all, the webs we weave throughout all this is very, and I said it at the beginning, there's so many interesting stories that this documentary is going to be, it's going to be hard to edit.
Well, let me throw something at you, Paul, because I appreciate your interest in this, and you're darn right it's going to be hard to edit. And thank goodness, as I said earlier, it's up to Jason Figgis to do it, but Jason never likes me to do this. And if you're listening, Jason, sorry, Paul and I are going to do it. Paul, knowing as much as you do about Bram Stoker's life from your own research, your own reading and stuff you and I've talked about, how do you think this documentary film should sort of wind down? You know, if you were the editor, not to say that Jason's going to do what you say, but if you were, one of the things that people have always asked me, what do you think Bram Stoker would feel knowing that he died in 1912 and his book didn't even become a play until the 20s, didn't have any idea how famous it was going to make him, and everything that comes as a result of it that's all around my room and my cupboard and my bookshelves, as yours as well, Paul. How do you think you wind down a documentary in a way that you end up with a good feeling, so to speak? You like some kind of a decent feeling at the end, even of the documentary. It doesn't have to be a super happy ending. But so how do you think, what should we take into consideration, Paul, to if you were to give a note to Jason, what would you say about that?
So I think if I were doing it, I would essentially end it with the book release, kind of fade to black for a second, and then do like a fast forward to modern day where Dracula is everywhere. You know, exactly what you were just saying, that all the stuff that he knew nothing about, you know, and, you know, with like a voiceover of this is what he missed. Because the same thing happened with Van Gogh, you know.
Yes, yes. Sold one painting in his life.
And then yeah, becomes hugely famous, you know, yeah. But now you have this guy who he wrote books. He, you know, he writes what is ultimately considered probably the best vampire novel in history, and becomes the basis for the best movie, the best play. And you're right, he knows none of it. So it's almost like if you're telling his story, you bring it to a close right around the book release and his death. And then you fast forward to where all of this is just everywhere, and just kind of talk about how, yeah, he missed it all, but look at what he left us.
Yeah. Yeah. Look what we have as a result of a very interesting, diverse and complex man's life.
Yeah.
So if you're listening to this, have a thought yourself. I'm not offering you an email address to send me your thoughts, but just
to think it yourself. Comments.
Post. There you go. Post and comment. How do you think this thing should end, or should it end? You know, is it left in a way that, as Paul said, Dacre and Jason and John get all excited, and somebody says, "Great guys, give us more."
I said, "Cause yeah, that's the other thing. If you end it at like the book and just fade out and fast forward to where it's all just like modern day people talking about, you know, Dracula this, and you just kind of do like a pan through of Dracula being everywhere, you can pick right back up on another one right after, you know, book to play, play to movie, movie to, you know, going into that legacy that got to that fast forward point."
Yeah.
And it still leaves it open for a second documentary without having to backtrack too much.
Here's a little tidbit for you. Depending on when this airs, you triggered a thought, Paul. I'm going to be in Derby, England. They actually pronounce it Derby, but it's written D-E-R-B-Y. April 24th and 25th. This is the 100th anniversary this year of the first appearance of Dracula on stage anywhere. Is it Derby or Derby, England? I'm going to be there doing one of my Stoker and Stoker talks with dramatic readings by local actors and so on. And the next night, I'm actually doing Stoker on Stoker, the novel Dracula, from novel to stage to screen. So I'm going to do one night, one the other night, right in the same location where Dracula was first performed. Edmund Blake was the first Dracula, not Bela Lugosi. So that's kind of timely for this this podcast. So that's where I'll be when this kind of comes out. And then I go to Whitby, which is one of my favorite places. May 26th is, of course, the 127th anniversary of Dracula being published. The people call it World Dracula Day because that's May 26th, 1897 is when Dracula came out. So, yeah, and then later in the year, I'll be off to Transylvania. So besides, please, folks, think about supporting Figgis and Stoker and West, Father Dracula Indiegogo. Follow me on my Facebook page, bramstokerestate.com, dacrestoker.com. If you're really into all this stuff, and one day, Paul, you got to come with me to one of these trips. We're actually renting Dracula's Castle or Bran Castle this Halloween. Actually, on the 28th, we've got it. And we're putting together a big announcement for that soon. That's this little insight to you guys. We're renting the whole thing and going to have some very interesting people there. Stoker Wines is debuting. This is a Romanian wine company that I've got a small interest in. A friend of mine has purchased. And we're going to have some interesting personalities there. So if you ever wanted to go to Transylvania and do a short tour and spend Halloween in one of the coolest, spookiest places, get a hold of me on my Facebook page and get some details.
Now, before we put this visit to bed, I've often wondered, and it hit me as I was getting ready for today, that I don't think I've ever asked you this. In all your research, have you come across any of Bram's like childhood homes still standing?
The first home he was in on Merino Crescent in Clontarf is still standing. The second home in Artane, which is just a few miles away from that, is not still standing. Another home on Buckingham Street in Dublin, when he was a little bit older. So that is still standing. And then another one in the town. So it was common in those days for middle-class people to rent homes and move based on where the majority of the people in the home had to either go to school or work. So the Stokers lived in the outskirts of Dublin, Ireland, and Clontarf. Father would take a carriage into town or take a tram into town when it was built. And the boys would have to walk to school, and then they moved a little bit closer when they went to Trinity College. So my wife has found 7 different locations in and around Dublin based on the tax records. And I believe 4 of them, I'm pretty sure 4 of them are still standing. 2 of them have those blue plaques on them that show the location. Oh, wait, gets better, Paul, because you and I like this kind of thing. The house where he was born in 2012, the 100th anniversary of his death, the owners of it had owned it for about four generations. So there was only one other owner between the Stoker family and the people that had it for these four generations. They had a big party in there and they invited family members and so on. So we all gathered in Ireland, in Dublin, for the 100th anniversary of Bram's death, had a church service, had a big dinner, all this stuff. And they invited everybody into the house to have a drink. And we did, so we could take pictures, we could go upstairs to see Bram's room. And then about 3 years later, the house went on the market to sell. Somebody bought it. Of course, they offered it to family members, but nobody was in the position to pay, you know, $1 million for a house in a beautiful neighborhood now. And it wasn't appropriate to turn it into a museum because it was in a residential neighborhood. But my cousin who lives over there knew the building contractor. And he said, Dacre, are you going to be over anytime in the next couple of months? Because they're doing massive renovations to the place. They're, you know, stripping down the walls and taking things off. And I said, yeah, as a matter of fact, I'm coming over for this festival in October. He says, well, I'm going to get you into the house because they're pulling off layers of wallpaper and stuff like that. So I was allowed to go in and I had brought a bunch of Ziploc bags so I could collect pieces of the crown molding, pieces of the plaster, pieces that still had the wallpaper from when Bram was in that room. How freaking cool is that? So I was like this little scavenger and the contractor thought this was pretty funny. Paul, there was a pile of this stuff out in the street, you know, in the dumpster. And I'm thinking, if somebody had the right mind, they could sell that for, you know, little bags of it for millions of dollars if you could authenticate it. I wasn't into that as much as like, I just wanted to have my own little piece, you know, something close to, you know, his DNA or whatever was floating around.
No, that's insane.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, you're right. That pile would have netted quite the little fortune.
I mean, nowadays people go to Transylvania and they come back and they go and steal dirt from the grounds of Bran Castle, or now since I've found where the castle site is, no castle up in the Colomani Park, and they steal bits of dirt and bring it back and sell it in little vials. But you don't know if they're taking it from the real place. You know, how do you authenticate that stuff?
Well, beat them to it. Sell it yourself.
I'd rather take them on the tour and experience it rather than get into kitsch stuff. I love bringing people over there. I love taking people to Cruden Bay, Scotland, where Bram wrote the novel, where he walked on the beach, got his ideas, to Whitby, where he got all his ideas and used, you know, museum and library to find stuff, and Transylvania to feel the presence of superstition and folklore of Vlad Dracula and Count Dracula, a lot of good stuff.
Hell yeah. So, you know, obviously, folks, follow him on Facebook and his socials. And, of course, head over to Indiegogo and support Father of Dracula. Because I can't be the only one that wants to see this damn thing at this point.
Thank you, Paul. I hope you're not the only one. just the two of us sitting back in a movie theater.
Yeah, I've done it before. But... you know, listeners, I'll put all of those links in the episode description, and you can follow me and other great podcasters over at electronicmediacollective.com, or if you just want to follow me, head over to YouTube and X at Moose Media Inc., or just follow Moose's Monster Mash on Facebook. Dacre, as always, this has been as educational as it is fun, and I not only hope this gets made, I think we can do something together with it after it's made.
I would like that. Definitely like that. I'll take you up on that.
So I'd say I'd invite you back, but I'm sure you're going to be back at some point. So I can't wait until the next time you're back. but thank you for coming on. And I can't wait to see how this progresses and how you're always discovering more of Bram's history. So there's like I said at the beginning, there's always something new. And I think that's what makes us fun. There's always a new tidbit.
And I really love sharing it with you because I know you're appreciative of it and your listeners are. So the more I dig, the more I polish, the more I share, and this is a great place to do it. So thanks again, Paul, and all you listeners.
And until next time, Horror Hounds, mash on.
This has been Moose's Monster Mash. Come back for more chills and thrills if you dare.